Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and thank you for joining us for another episode of our book club. Somebody asked me about the book club. How do you pick the books? We do. We have about 50 books a year that we'll have on the show. We'll talk with authors about. But for the book club, we pick six books. And we have to like the book a lot. But it also, the author also has to have some ties to Wisconsin, or the book has to be set in Wisconsin or have ties to Wisconsin, or both, all those things. And we like to sometimes take a book that has been out for maybe a year or two, and we want to kind of renew attention to the book. And all those things I've just mentioned exist in the book that we're talking about with you today. It's Blue Lake is the title of the book, and I hope you've had a chance to read it. The author with me in the studio is Jeffrey Bolt. Jeffrey is a graduate of UW-Madison School of Law. He received his MFA in fiction from Augsburn University in Minneapolis. In 2019, his short fiction, poetry, essays have appeared in several literary journals, and Blue Lake is his first novel. So, have you read Blue Lake? Let us know what you thought about the novel, questions about it. Maybe you want to talk about the writing process. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Jeffrey Bolt, it's great to have you with us and with me in the studio today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Larry, and thank you for establishing the book club. It's just another one of your many contributions to quality of life in Wisconsin, and very much appreciate it.
Well, let's talk about the novel for a minute. Why did you decide to write this particular novel, Blue Lake, as your first one?
You know, I had thought about writing a novel for a number of years, and you know, some of the ideas you have beforehand you can use, and some of them you let go of, you know. But one of the ones that I had that I was able to make use of was I was intrigued by exploring the situation where two people are flirting around and falling in love, and they're kind of wrapped up in that romantic fog and atmosphere, and they're slow to realize that there's some sinister forces in the background that put their lives in danger. So, and from there, I started layering in other aspects that hopefully led organically from the character's life, and that made it kind of a genre hybrid where it's intentionally equal parts legal thriller, romance, and a literary novel of place set here in Wisconsin. You know, that environmental stuff, from my perspective, I did environmental hearings for the state for almost 25 years. And environmental issues have such an urgency to them that I wanted to have that kind of thriller-like vibe. And so that's why I opened with a prologue where the Jason Erickson, the central protagonist, is a judge, He's lying in a UW hospital room. Yeah. He's been shot. He's not sure who put him there. And the reader gets to learn that along with Jason. So my hope was to have kind of a slowly building mystery and suspense that came out of the lives of the characters after you got to know them more intimately.
Yeah.
Like you would in a more literary novel.
Yeah, well, you did a wonderful job with that. And this whole business of Jason and Tara kind of falling in love despite some of their circumstances. Clara asked me once, our producer Clara Neipert said to me, how can falling in love sometimes make us blind to reality?
Yes. Clara says it very well.
She did. And I've got Jason and Tara. Let's go with the four main characters.
Oh, thanks, Larry. The two who are falling in love are Jason and Tara. Jason is a divorced attorney in his mid-40s. He had a similar job to the one I had. He travels around Wisconsin hearing environmental cases. And it's in one of his cases where he meets Tara. She's an unhappily married environmental journalist. They meet cute, kind of, in a flop house in Alma along the Mississippi River. Flop house that I've actually stayed in when I was doing hearings. But Tara's about to hit 40. She's feeling her biological clock ticking there, and her husband's not interested in having children. They've kind of drifted apart. Both Jason and Tara are lonely, and they're kind of in a mid-career slump there. The other two main characters are Earl Frank, who's kind of a hotshot lawyer from Chicago, and he represents a shady developer in part because the guy has something for him over him with gambling debts. So Earl's kind of a lovable rogue in some way, a charming villain. He used to live in Wisconsin and was actually attorney general and a Supreme Court justice. But then he needed to make some more money, so he fell in with this wrong crowd. And then finally, there's Grace. She's an environmental attorney in La Crosse, and from the environmental standpoint, she's kind of the hero of the whole book.
Yeah.
She's in her mid-40s, went to law school with Jason. That's how they know each other. And she's still making sense of how she's wound up in her hometown that late in life. And it resonated when I did a radio show in La Crosse of people. It's such a beautiful area that a lot of people really don't feel any reason to leave, and a lot of them come back too. Many of my friends have moved away and moved back there. But so every character has their own kind of narrative arc and their stories.
You know, Earl really intrigued me, and there's one thing. Oftentimes, I read lots of books every year and many, many novels, and often the villain has absolutely no redeeming qualities. And Earl, to me, turns out to be a really interesting character because you don't make him one-dimensional.
Right.
I mean, always a villain with no redeeming virtues.
No, he's a good father, and, you know, he's had his day as an environmental hero, too, which is why the unsavory folks want him and his knowledge, you know. But with Earl, it's interesting, Larry. He takes a role. There is a sequel that's coming out this fall, and it's called Big Lake Troubles, but Earl's really at the center of that one, and he grows even further and probably tries to redeem himself. And it's interesting. I workshopped that sequel with a group of writers from all over the U.S., very diverse crowd of, you know, geography, religion, race, everything. They all liked Earl.
Oh, man. I do want to get into this whole publishing business and so forth as we move along here, but we'll get to that. And there are so many locations. I love the fact that you write with some clarity about La Crosse and Madison and Milwaukee, American Players Theater, Green Bay. Some of the other areas you give, and those are real areas, and other places you give a fictional name, Lake Joseph, which I think is Lake Geneva.
You're not the first one to say that, Larry.
And Blue Lake itself, although I know some lake communities that are a lot like Blue Lake, which I often wished I was had a place there in a couple of those. I had a couple of those lakes just because of the way people who live there nurture the lake and fight for it.
Right. Well, that gets to the heart of why I did. You know, it was fun to write about the places that I love. I traveled the state, for 25 years, and have a favorite place in nature and a favorite restaurant in every county seat in the state, you know. But I've lived in Madison many years. I lived in Milwaukee. I grew up in La Crosse, and my family's still there, so I get back there pretty often. And of course, I loved setting the ending at American Players Theater to give it sort of this, let's try to get a little of the weight of the Shakespearean comedy there at the end. But the fictional towns, Blue Lake kind of represents one end of the, you know, the protection of natural resources, and Lake Joseph, and that's in part why I love Lake Geneva, actually, you know, and the area is so much fun. I just went there with my daughters here to celebrate our birthdays, but I didn't want to have the area that was more developed. I didn't want it to be a real place because I love those places too.
And
I think that's important. It's like, you know, we're part of nature too, and places that we like include some development often. But with Blue Lake in particular, it was about protecting the lake. It's a nice little town that I made up too. I had written some short stories too that were set in this fictional place called Blue Lake over the years. And so I wanted to incorporate that sort of idyllic North Woods, lake setting.
Jeffrey Bolt is our guest today. We're talking with him about his book. His book is entitled Blue Lake. Wonderful read. Questions for him. Have you read the book? Comment on it. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. This is our book club, and our guest, Jeffrey Bolt, is the author of Blue Lake, a wonderful story, a wonderful novel. And again, join in with your own questions, thoughts, comments. You may have questions about the book. You may have some questions about the themes in the book that we've talked about. We're going to spend a little more time, I think, talking about environmental issues, but the other themes as well. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Jeffrey, you know what? If you've got a little piece of something that you'd like to read for us, I think that would be great. For people just tuning in late a little bit, this will set the stage again.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, the prologue is, I use some kind of a device from the 70s, and I have titles for all the chapters. The prologue is titled On the Twisted Something Express. It's a little over a page here. A swirling flood of memory fragments, fleeting, chaotic, then little islands of recollection, a trial, the bathroom stall, avoiding the hook on the inside door, that weirdly lettered envelope. Footsteps, but no one there. Running on the street toward the sheriff's department. The dude in the baseball cap. He'd been shot by someone he didn't know. He was pretty sure of that. There was a struggle, he remembered, but not with the man in the baseball cap who'd followed him. No, he was suffocating, choking to death on his own blood. He'd fought with the ambulance guys. Had he really pulled off the oxygen mask to tell them he couldn't breathe? Was that idiot him? They must have sedated him at some point. He could recall little after the moment when two paramedics forced a fat needle into his chest, in for a second and then back out. His memory whirled around aboard a wobbly state fair ride, the name of which he couldn't remember. The Twisted Something. Loved it as a kid. I could go on, but you get the idea.
Yeah.
Trying to have a sensory, just coming to, and his whole life's kind of swirling around in his mind there as he's trying to figure out how he got there.
And this book, you've had such a, you know, maybe we should talk about you for a minute, a bit more about you. You've had such an interesting career. your law degree, but then you went to get an MFA. And I wondered if that, I know your wife passed away, and there's a wonderful piece that you wrote about it. And I wondered if that had kind of been the trigger for wanting to go on for an MFA.
It was probably, without a doubt, it was a way. I kind of applied on a whim to this program at Augsburg University that required you to do 3 summer residencies. And so over 2 years that I wrote Blue Lake was actually my master's thesis. But, you know, I had been through 3 years almost of chemo with my late wife, and I had also endured a bunch of really complex cases in my career. So I had the opportunity to retire. I think it was 2016 when I retired. You know, I think some of my own, when you're writing a longer piece like a novel, I think some of my own emotional life kind of seeps in there. And what you're looking for when you're writing fiction is the emotional truth more than the specific facts. And, you know, I think at that time we were talking before we went on the air, Larry, but I think at that time there was a feeling, too, that the Wisconsin that I'd known and loved, you know, that featured the our natural resources and that included the Wisconsin idea and this sort of nice, moderate political culture that had produced both Warren Knowles as a Republican governor and Scott McCallum, all who had strong environmental records, and Gaylord Nelson, who did so much for shoreline zoning. And, you know, in that tradition, it seemed like that itself was under threat. And so there was almost a grieving for the Wisconsin that I loved. One other reviewer said it was like a love letter to Wisconsin and the upper Midwest. And I think part of that was coming out of that feeling that, hey, this is valuable. Let's preserve it. Yeah. Whether it's the nature and, you know, or the climate crisis. My next book addresses that a little more head on. But you know, do we want to live in a state that has the blue corner butterfly? Do we want to live in a state that has the call of the loons on the lakes at night? Or, you know, tourism is a huge business in this state. Mm-hmm. It's right up there. And so that's why I think that was why we always had this culture that valued our natural resources. And that's part of what I, you know, as you're writing a long piece, more layers are added as you go along. And, you know, certainly that working through that was healthy for me, both in terms of moving on from my work as an administrative law judge and also trying to overcome the grief that I felt from losing my wife.
Yeah, it was... amazing the way you put it together. The environmental issues, and there are kind of like a couple. One stands out more than the other. One had to do with piers, and I forget the term that you used for it. What was slipominium or something?
Right. Yeah, in Wisconsin, there was a case like that. It was Docominium's case, and it was a case that I actually held in my professional life. But that issue had been decided by the time the book came out. But it was an interesting kind of concept and a way to get Earl in there and to have this sort of shady developer possibility there. The other case was the groundwater contamination case. And that's, you know, that's an issue that we have in this state and all around the country about. You know, we've built up this new industrial form of particularly meat production. So we have these concentrated animal feeding operations. And, you know, the environmental issue that stems from that, there's a couple, you know, the carbon from the manure. But also, you know, what do we do with all that waste? And,
yeah.
You know, it gets out there and... I had a number of those. Those were the complex cases that I mentioned earlier, Larry, about, you know, right before I left. I did a few of those. And, you know, I was frankly shocked at some of the water quality issues that people were experiencing in areas, particularly areas that had the karst features geologically, where there's cracks and, you know, some of the manure can just travel a long distance before, you know, after it spread on a field. And, you know, there was not, and I don't believe still yet, there's a whole lot of regulations and law to try to deal with this problem. There are some hopeful things on that, though. One of them is the digesters that they're using now. People feel there's mixed feelings on that too, because it may put in place, you know, kind of institutionalize these large, you know, dairies of 10,000 plus cows, or, you know, whatever, hog farms in Iowa is a big issue. But it, in terms of treating the waste and getting that problem out, both as the carbon, you know, people, I've heard recently that in some areas, the manure is worth more than milk because of carbon credit markets that have come up in California. So a lot of the big CAFOs, as my understanding, are going to these digesters because they can also get carbon credits and then sell those. So it's always an ongoing thing, and, you know, I'm trying to keep up just basically from the perspective of an informed citizen now.
Well, I tell you, the descriptions of the local people who were affected in this one area having to do with this were, having to wash a baby or whatever, your young child, in water that you wouldn't be able to drink even.
Right. No, and worrying the mothers, and I did hear a testimony like that, mothers worrying that their kid would just take in a couple of drops when you're bathing them in this water that's contaminated with, you know, fecal matter from cows, and then it gets complicated to prove, did it really come from this big dairy? You know, they get down to, like, do you have the DNA from an individual cow, you know, to really truly prove it, you know. And I think we can take some proactive measures and work this through a little more thoughtfully, but that would require legislation probably.
My eyes went up when I saw that in the book. It was Grace, I think, maybe talking with the attorney, who was kind of the hero in a lot of ways in this book, certainly the environmental hero, thinking about having to determine which particular cow might have created the problem. I mean...
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, Jeffrey Bolt, our guest today, his book, Blue Lake. Give us a call with your questions or comments. The number, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Let's talk a little more about Grace. There's another interesting character because talk about Grace a little bit.
Well, like I said before, Grace is a widow. She lost her husband when she and her late husband and Jason were all in law school together. And, you know, she's acquired, I guess, her late uncle's practice in La Crosse and is building. And he's definitely a real figure in her life. And but she wasn't planning to live in La Crosse the rest of her life when she went on to law school. But I think she comes to some peace with it as the book unfolds. And her work is so important to her. And, you know, she doesn't need a man. She doesn't need a whole lot more than what she has going on in her life. And I like the character of Grace very much.
I liked her an awful lot, and I kind of like how it turned out with her, for her too, which we won't go into all of that. But But she also had a chance. You raised a nice thing. She had a chance to sell the building,
right?
Which would have could have taken her made a lot of money on it, and would have allowed her to leave.
Right, and La Crosse, downtown La Crosse is thriving. You know, and hopefully with the new train lines coming in there, that more people around the upper Midwest will come to know and love my hometown. It's such a beautiful area. There's bike trails and, you know, just lively restaurants downtown and bookstores. And, you know, it's a great weekend getaway from for people around the state who are not aware of it. It's a real treasure of our state.
I love the La Crosse area. And as a matter of fact, Jill's going to our executive producer is going to have to remind me about it. I think it's in 2 weeks we will be doing a show from there.
Oh, great.
We've been taking the show on the road a little bit, and so we'll be in La Crosse, and I think it's in 2 weeks. September 11th, she tells me.
Oh, is that right? I think they used to broadcast from the top of Granddad's Bluff. I'm not sure if they still do, but it's certainly a beautiful setting for your time there, Larry.
Well, our transmitters have, as Jack Mitchell said, our transmitters have mostly been located on state-owned property.
Oh, yeah.
And parks, so
right, yeah.
That was originally eliminated a lot of issues that we might have had in getting the whole network of stations established. Yeah. So, let's get back to your career as an administrative law judge. One of the interesting things I found about that was you, and I should have realized it, but explain what that job entails, because that is really interesting to me.
Yeah, you know, it's a position that's technically part of the executive branch of state government, and different agencies have different rules as to how much authority administrative law judge has. In some areas they do sort of provisional proposed decisions. In other areas where it comes from federal law in particular, and a lot of environmental law and cases come out of both the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, and I did those cases. And those give you quite a bit of authority from the administrative law judge, and so the decision as it is, or at least as was during my time. I don't know what changes have been made, but decision of the administrative law judge is supposed to be the final decision of the Department of Natural Resources in just about every area except landfill siting. They reserve for the secretary, but then the secretary of the particular agency has an opportunity to review the decision usually, and they can make changes. Historically, they were not wanting to do that a whole lot. It has happened, but in my career, I can't recall ever having one of my decisions overturned by the secretary. I'm thinking there, but what did happen late in my career was there was some pressure to try to change one of these groundwater contamination cases after the time limits had expired for an appeal. So, you know, the law needs finality. Business needs finality as much as individual citizens or people who are concerned about the impacts of something. And that was quite unsettling to me that, you know, people spend a lot of money to go through that hearing process. And then, you know, there was some, you know, political decision was made to try to reverse the decision after those time limits had run. And I didn't really like that, and I tried to speak out to the extent that I thought was appropriate in my role. But fortunately, the appellate courts, including ultimately the Wisconsin Supreme Court, put that decision back essentially how I had decided it in the course of my job. But yeah, it is a very, it's a very strange, you know, so I think of it as kind of low to the ground, you know, judge, you know, you're a judge, but you're not in a robe, you're not part of the, you know, you're not elected. Like we are in county judges. So there's some tension there. You know, I think some people feel that you're just a bureaucrat. And the idea, you know, that came out of the Federal Administrative Procedures Act was that people would develop some expertise, you know, from deciding those cases. I personally, I think we need that. And, you know, I have some concerns, too, about the U.S. Supreme Court's recent decision to overturn the what's called the Chevron Doctrine. Mm-hmm. It's very big on the environmental area that provided that finality. If there was an ambiguous statute, you know, the agency's interpretation of the ambiguity was given great weight in deference. And now that's going to be open season. It's going to be very hard. It's my own years. I had the sense that you know, it was very hard to get environmental regulations into effect at the federal level. There's a long process, and then they get them in. They finally, you know, they'd have to take comments from the public and from all sectors, and they finally get them in, and then the next administration would come in and reverse them at the federal level. That's unfortunate because, you know, we're all breathing the same air. We all enjoy a beautiful sunset in front of a pristine lake, and you know, we all care about our kids. And you know, there has to be some balance. The law, specifically in Wisconsin, oftentimes requires you to balance interests, and I think that's really what we got to get back to. What I loved about the job, Larry, was the creative process of trying to find a win-win.
Yeah,
you know, and that's what I think our culture needs right now is let's get back to win-win, whether it's the environment or you know, how we talk to each other. Anyway, that's my take on the ALJ job that Jason has too. And he's feeling some pressure too.
And that job, I mean, you can't go into that job, into a particular case with your mind made up before you the role, and Jason's role and your role was to look at the facts, examine those facts, and then, as you say, try and figure out what's a win-win for everybody.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Larry. The job was to make findings of fact and then make conclusions of law from that. And so that's what your decision was often called, the findings of facts, conclusions of law, and order. And it was very rewarding work, especially when you could get to the win-win. You know, I don't think people who are trying to develop a piece of property, they're not. Most of them are very upstanding, good people. And mm-hmm. and like I said, with the balancing there, too, of people like some development and some, yeah, you know, opportunities as well. So,
well, I tell you what, Jason, and we got another aspect of this job, and later on, we're at noon today, we're going to talk about professionalism in the workplace. And Jason and Tara go out for, how they get to know each other a little bit is they go out for a drink, I think, is how it...
Let's see.
They knew each other beforehand.
Oh, yeah. No, they meet in that flap house that I mentioned before, and they do have a beer together. They both had a long day with a meat process. I mean, remaindering plant that's making pet food, which I have done some cases like that too. And yeah, there's not a whole lot you can do. That's one area where it's very hard to find a win-win. It smells bad. It smells bad. You know, it's like it has to get to a level that's pretty intolerable. You know, before you have the authority to do anything, but.
But Jason and Tara, there. So that relationship, and is that in real life? Can a judge have a beer with a reporter?
I think so. Sure, they're both neutrals. There's no, you know, and some of this culture is you know, there's county judges that would go out with prosecutors, you know, for a beer or a drink, and I'm not sure how common that is, but you know, as a neutral, they're both neutral. They're not, you know, violating anyone's, you know, probably the reporter's likely trying to get some information from the judge. You know, but that's part of our process too, I guess.
As long as you don't discuss the whatever case.
Right, right. Yeah. And I don't think they do. I think they're too taken with each other.
Jeffrey Bolt, our guest today, his book is titled, the novel, our book club selection, Blue Lake. And it's great to have him with us. Questions for him or a comment? I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll have some advice for you about workplace professionalism and how to create healthy relationships with your coworkers. Hopefully you already have them, but if you don't, we've got some advice for you, and I hope you'll join in for that. And I also wanted to mention that we will be September 11th at the Black River Beach Community Center, Neighborhood Center, Black River Beach Neighborhood Center on September 11th in La Crosse for a show, a live show. Right now, talking with Jeffrey Bolt about his book, Blue Lake. Questions for him about the writing process, about the lake, about the novel itself, or maybe about some of the issues we've been talking about. I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address talk@WPR.org. You know, I like some of the particulars in the book. There was one that I thought, I wonder if this is true. Jason is at the Pfister Hotel, or at least thinking about the Pfister Hotel, because I think his mother used to like to go there, if I recall rightly. But then remembers that the new owners had learned the value of the art in the Pfister Hotel actually exceeded the value of what they paid for it. And I wondered if that was in fact the case.
That's my understanding. I'm not an appraiser, but there's quite valuable sort of Victorian art there. I'm sure you've spent time there as
yes.
I have.
Yeah.
And up in Blue, I love Blue, the lounge at the top there. It's a beautiful view, and it was fun to have a scene there. It's such a historic hotel, and people say it's haunted. I don't know. There are some players on professional teams that come to Milwaukee that won't go there.
Is that right?
Yeah, because they claim to have had experiences with ghosts, and it's such an institution in Milwaukee. I love Milwaukee, too.
Well, and there's a... Is that where the bathroom scene takes place?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, they're at an EPA conference, you know, from the 7th District or the Chicago area.
Well, that was one of the little factoids. But there's another case, and I don't even know. I don't think I want to go into the whole thing. But I have never laughed when I was reading a book or a novel about somebody trying to commit suicide. And I have to say that I laughed out loud when that came up.
Yeah, you know, the reviewer liked that too, for Kirkus Review. So, you know, I was lucky. I got a name to the best books of 2022 by Kirkus Reviews, but that was something that they singled out as it was particularly appropriate for my themes too, because the character, I won't say who, but they have a hybrid car that doesn't generate enough fume for him to actually undo himself. So.
Oh yeah, it's I love that. How did you? I mean, did you always want to be a writer?
I actually did, Larry. I had the either fortune or misfortune, I don't know, of publishing a poem in a quite a prominent academic journal when I was an undergrad, and so I had enough success. Then I lived in New York City, and I was trying to be a writer there. I had a couple of times where I tried to seriously write. Another time was my late wife was working for the UN, and we were living in Rome, and I was basically a house husband, but I wrote a legal thriller then as well. It was the problem I had with that was the mail was so slow in Italy. I would say, "Oh, send us the next 100 pages," and a year later, it'd be kind of late. But and that book probably wasn't ready at that point. But no, I've always had this sort of literary or historic kind of consciousness, I guess, that you have in your mind when you read a lot, and you have some thoughts, words are important to you. I always thought, Larry, that there's a kind of a connection between poetry and law, where one word can be so important. You know, we have cases where, there's numerous appellate decisions on, arguing about what's the meaning of three words. And that's kind of what poets do too, trying to get a depth in every line and multiple meanings. And so, yeah, I wrote poetry over many years. I always tried to publish something every year when I was working, whether it was a story or an essay or more likely poems, because those were, I had the time to do that. And
I was interested in, here you are, what were you, 50 years old when you started your MFA? And
beyond that, yeah, no, I was in my late 50s, and there's a story there too that the residencies, like I said, the first summer they require you to stay in the dorms. So I was in my late 50s, and unfortunately, well, again, a mixed blessing, but they were building this beautiful new building on the Augsburg campus, and it's just gorgeous. We used it the next year, but my first summer, I just lost my dad, and I was upset about that. And then they had this big construction light out that was to prevent people from falling into this construction site, but it was shining right into my dorm room there. I was pretty miserable there. There was a time where I thought, well, do I really want to do this, but there were people of various ages and backgrounds, and it was a great experience. I had some, that's why this book, the complexity and the sort of crossing genre and all that, I had my professors to bounce my ideas off of, and got a lot of good feedback that was helpful. Now, the second book, I've been more on my own, but you can find editors, and now my publisher, my last editor, has just been terrific. So,
you kind of went about things. Some people get involved with writers' groups.
Right, right. I had this idea, and I also, frankly, I needed something else in my life at that moment. I could sit there and be sad, or I could move forward. And I decided to go into it whole hog. It was kind of a whim when I applied, I was surprised to be accepted, and it serves me well now, because you know, you learn a lot of the technique of, you know, writing in a way that it's hard to replicate from my perspective with just a writer's group. You know, it's hard when you're friends, especially to give like real hard
criticism. Yeah. Honest criticism.
Yeah, the way it works best, I think, in the sort of workshopping mode, one things that I've learned, and I did workshop this book, so I'm certainly using that now, but people say, what's alive? What's working here? And what are your questions? So your questions could be about the plot. It could be about the writing. Could be about the characters. And that's a way to do it that's not, like, personal to everyone's. A lot of writers are probably on the, you know, shy side or, you know more withdrawn sometimes. Not all of them. Some of them are very out there. But and so, you know, you don't want to hurt someone's feelings, but just want to give them that that critique.
Yeah, and you're right about, I've talked to so many writers over the years, hundreds, and I don't know the percentage, but it's a pretty high percentage of people who say they don't like being out in, they'd rather be alone more than anything, but they have to be out.
Yeah,
because that's where your experiences come from and all that.
Right.
How has the book done?
It's doing really well. You mentioned I've had that essay that I wrote about my late wife, and that's generated. And thank you for your. I love the concept that you wait until the book's out a while to try to rekindle interest, and I appreciate that, Larry. But the book's been doing really well recently again, where probably in the last few weeks I've had as many sales almost as I did when I first you know, had all the publicity. But yeah, that was just from people who were touched by my essay about my late wife, and I heard from, well, the first original go-round on HuffPost got 2.3 million readers, and then it went on BuzzFeed, and based on the volume that's coming, I don't have a number from then. I don't have an editor there. I had an editor at HuffPost, but based on the volume of people coming to my website, it's even more, you know, and they've been kind enough to be interested in buy my book. So
that is, I know that is not what you had in mind when you wrote that essay. I could tell that from the essay. I read the essay, and it's a beautiful, beautiful essay.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I was really trying to help people with grief, and I think the response to that article shows that how pervasive that is. You know, I know you've experienced grief in your life. I'm a listener enough to know some of your story too, Larry. And and it's not an easy thing to go forward, but you have to.
Yeah. Daughter died when I'm on the air, and I took a week off. Then you're. But you have to, it takes a lot longer than a week.
If ever.
If ever.
Yeah.
Well, this has been really great, Jeffrey. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. And I hope you sell a million.
Oh, well, thanks, Larry. And I just want to say, as we were talking a little bit before we got on the air, it's such a joy to meet you, and I've listened to you for years, and you have been such a resource for the people of Wisconsin and Minnesota too. Growing up in La Crosse, I know they listen to you as well. But it's really an honor.
Thank you, Jeffrey Bolt. Get a copy of his book if you haven't read it already. It's titled Blue Lake. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. We're taking our next segment up with the topic of human resources management and being a professional in the workplace. And a couple of expert guests to visit with as we go through the hour. Alicia Nagel, one of them, an instructor of practice in the business management department of Marquette University's College of Business Administration. Alicia, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Larry. Great to be here. I'm a huge fan.
Well, thank you. And Rick Laguerre is our other guest. Rick's an assistant professor of human resources at Marquette University as well. Rick, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us here. I cannot wait to talk about this topic. It's so important, and we definitely have a lot to say about it.
I bet you do, and I know it's an important topic. And as you listen to our experts, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you work in human resources management. What do you wish people knew about your job? Or maybe you're wondering about setting boundaries with a coworker, or maybe there are other issues as part of your work that you wish were better. Or maybe you've got a really good thing going in your workplace, and you want to tell us about that. I'd love to hear all sides of that. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. You know, I think a lot of people have, well, they certainly heard about human resources departments, or HR, as we, you know, typically, you know, let's go to HR for that. But there are I've had a lot of experience with HR over the years in a number of capacities, good and most of the time. But what are the responsibilities of HR specialists in the workplace? Alicia, we'll start with you, and Rick can join in.
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah, so I think, Larry, just taking a step back, HR is a function that exists in organizations, private, public, not-for-profit, just like other functions we're aware of, accounting, supply chain, sure, procurement. The role of an HR practitioner or an HR professional is to enable the success of that organization, just like all other functions. They happen to do it, though, through a unique set of levers. So as an example, an HR professional's role would be to ensure success by making sure that they have recruited, hired the right people at the right time with the right set of skills. So their job really is, again, to enable organizational success through people, through talent, through organizational structure, through policies, practices, as well as many, many opportunities to influence the culture of these organizations.
Yeah. Rick, anything to add to that?
Yeah. I would also add that when we think of the term human resources, normally when we just talk about resources, we think about, you know, money, gold, oil, minerals, any kind of minerals, and that's sort of easy to associate with resources. But when the reason why we call it human resources is actually because you can take minerals and money, etc., and you could put it in front of a desk at a computer, and that resource itself cannot do the job for you. It cannot make the business run. So humans, people, are the engine of an organization, and it's actually the most important resource. So when then thinking about it from that perspective, you can see, okay, so the better people you recruit, how you treat them, how you manage this resource will determine how successful an organization will be in the long term.
Well, you know, and I always thought a better term might have been people resources than human resources. I don't know how it ever landed on human resources, but people resources just...
Agreed.
Sounded better to me. It just sounded like it just was boldly stating what we're all about here. And I guess human is, yeah, it's fine. But people resources, I always thought might have been a better way to put it. So you talked about things that you can do. Are there things that you can't do?
As an HR practitioner, I mean, I don't think so. A lot of it is dependent on the size and scale of an organization. Obviously, the bigger the organization gets, I mean, we have a lot of global multinationals. If you work at a global multinational, there's a really good chance that you're really more of a specialized practitioner, right? So you practice one very specific and unique aspect of HR. Rick mentioned recruiting, right? There are many, many people who work in large organizations and they have one job to do, and it's to find and recruit and be a part of hiring the top talent, right? If you're in a smaller organization, maybe with not quite as much breadth and depth, maybe you're going to have responsibility for multi, areas of HR, right? You may be a recruiter. You may also be in charge of, setting competitive compensation and benefits for employees. You may also be in charge of internal and external communications. So I think I would say there's probably nothing that's sort of out of scope for an HR practitioner, but what they do and the sort of breadth and depth of what they have responsibility for is probably more a function of the organization that they're in and maybe even the unique industry that they are supporting.
Yeah, and in a lot of businesses, the biggest expense of the business is paying the salaries. So people's salaries. And so if you don't pick the right people or select the right people for the job, you're creating a lot of problems. you're losing money in some ways, and you may also be losing some other parts of the job. The social system itself can break down if you don't have the right person in the job. Dennis in Two Rivers has a question for you, so let's go there. Dennis, hi.
Hello, Larry. People resources could be good, too, because I think the departments used to be called personnel departments, which could be, well, that's kind of like a list of the people, and, okay, here they are, that's their job. But as far as resources, say here, well, we're integrating people, we're integrating humans, so the job is a resource to them, and they are a resource to the company. Would that fit?
Is it, well, Dennis, thanks. So what do you think about Dennis's idea?
Dennis raised actually a really good point about personnel departments, because a big part of an HR specialist or an HR practitioner is personnel selection. And there's a way to select people legally and illegally, for example. So, this is to Elisa's point that HR kind of touches every aspect of an organization. No matter what job type, you're hiring people, and it's up to the organization to demonstrate that they are being fair and just in how they hire people and are hiring people based on what we call bona fide occupational qualifications or the core aspects of the job. That down the line, if people are trying to work in an organization or trying to get a job, their foot in the door somewhere, it can't be based on someone. You're protecting yourself from litigation or from being sued if someone says you're being unfair in some way. The HR department would essentially have data that shows, no, this is the criteria. We're selecting these personnel. There's no foul play here. And, not only does it enable you to select the right people for the right job, but it also makes sure that legally you're protecting yourself as an organization and as an employer.
You're both educators. You're at Marquette University, a very respected, obviously, institution. Are you involved at all in research in these areas? I'd be curious to know something about the research that you do.
Yeah, if it's okay, Rick, let me jump in and then I'll pass it over to you pretty quickly here. And this is, Larry, it's kind of great that you have both myself and Rick here. I actually didn't grow up as an educator. I am an industry expert, so coming here to Marquette is a second career for me. So for me specifically, I'm not a researcher. I'm not a scholar. And this is just a little plug for Marquette. This is one of the things that our students really love about Marquette is when they come here, they do have many opportunities to get a very balanced education and exposure, right? They'll take classes with me. I obviously teach my classes in a slightly different way. I mean, our curriculum is, our books are the same, but I come at it in a different way than Rick would, who's a scholar and a researcher. So I'm gonna, Rick, turn it over to you and you can talk more about the specific question that Larry asked.
Yeah, so with respect to research, I study how HR policies and practices motivate people at different stages of their career. The aspect of a person's experience at work I really care about are people that are nearing retirement. How can we best keep their expertise and their knowledge and treat people in a way so that they don't retire early and leave the wealth of knowledge behind without transferring it to someone who's coming up in the organization. So employee motivation, HR policies and practices, and retaining talent at all stages of their careers.
Very cool. Alicia Nagel and Rick Laguerre, our guests today from Marquette University's College of Business Administration. And that's Alicia. And Rick is an assistant professor of human resources at Marquette University. Questions for them about the position, about the professionalism, maybe about the system that you're working in, you may have a question about. Number to call 800-642-1234 or just email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR. Just a reminder, if you missed part of our show or any show or just want to hear it again, you can always go to our archives at WPR.org/Larry to hear recordings and broadcasts. And there's you'll be able to click on a little video of me tagging a butterfly, a monarch butterfly, and sending it off into the world on its journey south. That's at WPR.org/Larry. Right now, we're taking a look at professionalism in the workplace with two human resources experts, Alicia Nagel and Rick Laguerre, and both with Marquette University. Rick's an assistant professor of human resources. And Alicia Nagel is an instructor of practice in the business management department there. So great to have them with us. Questions, comments, maybe an experience to share. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. So somebody's wondering, could you describe a healthy workplace environment? What does it look like?
Yeah. Rick, do you want me to?
Sure.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah, that's it's a great question. I would say the things that transcend industries and organizations, you know, regardless again of size and scale and whether you're, you know, private, public, for-profit, NGO, the things that really transcend organizations that I think should be considered healthy are really, to me, have a lot to do with communications. The culture, does the culture support open and transparent communications? Does the culture support individuals being supportive of one another? You know, I'm sure at some point today we're gonna talk about ethics, ethical behavior. You know, are leaders demonstrating and living those values? Are they themselves behaving in an ethical manner? Probably the last thing I would add is just personal accountability, personal responsibility. Healthy organizations create conditions where it's safe for people to take responsibility and accountability for things, right? If I am in an organization and everybody's afraid that they're going to get fired, they're going to lose their jobs, they're going to get demoted, right? Think about the kinds of behaviors that that triggers versus in organizations where leaders are the very first to raise their hand and say, that's on me. I could have done better, right? I didn't make the best decision. Let's figure out how we continue to move things forward. Those are really, really powerful kinds of things that leaders can do to create, embody healthy organizations.
And I suppose the opposite of that, I'm thinking what's a toxic place, yeah. workplace look like would almost be the opposite?
I think so. Imagine, you know, something goes wrong. We're human beings, like Rick was saying, we're not always going to make the best decisions. We're going to have limited data, limited information, maybe even not enough time to make decisions. We make mistakes at work. And yeah, the opposite of that, Larry, would be when things go south, you know, there's lots of finger pointing. It's not on me, it's on you. All right, this was your idea, not my idea, right? And those are all things that absolutely very, very quickly can turn around the culture of an organization, a healthy one, into an unhealthy and toxic one.
Yeah. And ultimately, who's responsible for improving the workplace environment or maintaining a good one?
And it's okay, you know, if your listeners don't agree with this. I have a pretty strong point of view on this. I really believe it's up to the leadership team. Leaders matter. Of course, in HR, I'm a lifelong HR practitioner myself. Of course, HR matters, right? We're in charge of developing and facilitating policies and practices. But ultimately, it is up to the leadership of an organization to create that kind of culture, to create healthy organizations, to be inclusive, to be tolerant, right? To respect people and their opinions and their ideas. So we all have responsibility for it, where the buck stops, right? The buck stops at the leadership team.
One thing that I would add in general, when kind of thinking, you know, how do you know if you're in a healthy versus an unhealthy organization?
Yeah.
Some people might never have experienced what a really good, healthy organization is versus one that's bad. So one way to kind of figure that out for yourself is think of how you feel in the morning before you go to work. What kind of mood are you in mentally? Are you feeling good? Physically, are you feeling good? And then how do you feel at the end of the day when you come back? Are you mentally in a good state? Are you happy? Or are you really angry or upset or irritated? And are you physically like in pain? So this idea of what a healthy organization is, it's sort of returning the person whole when they come home. You know, people have families, they have criteria, they have a lot of things that they want to do when they're not at work. So you go to work, you do your time, you put in your effort. But when you come back, are you a different person? Are you happy? Are you not? So that would be kind of a great indicator of what a healthy versus unhealthy organization is. One thing that I'll also add is, yes, leadership is important. And sometimes in an organization, there's a lack of leadership, and that can also lead to an unhealthy environment. So sometimes a leader might see that their people are being mean or rude to each other, or things are going wrong. And if a leader fails to act, then it's sort of, you leave everyone to their own devices. And so the importance of a leader is not only do you set the tone for how people should behave, but also it's important for a leader to recognize, hey, if I don't do anything, there's going to be a lot going on behind the scenes that I have no idea about. And
that's not good. Not good for sure. Judy in De Pere has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Judy. Judy,
good
are you there?
How are you?
Great.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, so I just did a presentation that I called Leading from a Place of Unity recently with some young adults from the Green Bay Area Chamber of Commerce. And I covered five different concepts that I think are really, really key to leading from a place of unity. And it's allowing your employees and also employing these in your own leadership, allowing people to truly become known. Allowing self-acceptance for all the pieces of ourselves, helping people to have a sense of true belonging, allowing vulnerability in the workplace and in the work that we do, and to have true encounters with other people, not just transactions, but true encounters. So this group of young people, I feel, felt that these were helpful. And I do believe that leading from a place of unity is a great way to develop a team that is, beholden to one another, is going to work hard together, because they do have that sense of unity and that sense of true belonging.
Yeah. Judy, thanks a lot for calling. Let's get some comments from our guests. Rick, what do you think?
Sure. Judy, thanks for your thoughts on this topic, and I couldn't agree with you more. What the research shows is really when people go to work and when they feel like they can be themselves and they can express ideas or thoughts or things that may be unpopular, and there's not going to be blowback or serious negative repercussions, the workplace is a lot friendlier, people thrive there, and the organization as a whole performs a lot better. So I definitely agree with your sentiment on leadership from a place of unity. And one thing that I'll add is one thing people might confuse with leadership is, oh, I need to be like that person or this someone else that isn't me. And a true leader or a great leader will be someone who is genuine and authentic, and they have a style that works for them. So that sort of ties into, self-acceptance and creating a place of unity. Because when employees see their boss as a real person or vulnerable or has real opinions and has a unique style and their own quirks, employees will feel more comfortable around that person and know that when a boss is asking me to do something or saying something to me, it's coming from a good place because this person is being genuine and authentic with me versus not.
And Elisa, you were nodding in agreement there.
Yeah. I was going to add what I love about what Judy shared with us is, that this was a program that she was delivering to young people. I don't know, she didn't mention how old they are, but let's just say, high school kids or people who are just launching, their professional careers. And I think I love that because, and this is actually closely aligned to one of the things that I believe in Marquette, is it's really important for us to educate young people around what's normal, what good looks like, right? To your point, Larry, about how do we know, whether this is a healthy or an unhealthy organization? Well, we know by telling young people what that looks like. What does healthy look like? What does good leadership look like? So that when they show up, and as I think back, started my career 30 plus years ago, I had no idea. I showed up my first day at work. I didn't know what was normal. I didn't know what was good leadership, bad leadership, right? Certainly I knew what it felt in my body, like Rick was saying, but you second guess yourself all the time. So I love that, Judy. Thank you for doing that. And I hope you'll continue to help young people develop skills and awareness around what good unity, you talked about that, but what good leadership looks like and feels like.
Judy, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. And you can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. This is something that I was thinking about, and then I see we have an email from somebody else with the same kind of question. The hybrid work environments that we, most of us are now in, how has that changed the how you might look at a successful business or a successful operation, I probably should say? Because it's a lot different.
It is. Yeah. Rick, if it's okay, I'll get this started as well. And I'm sure, Larry, in your organization, this is just something that everyone is, I don't want to say dealing with because that makes it sound like a negative thing, but these are new skills, right, that we're building and developing. I want to say, and you'll know by the end of my answer, that I'm a fan of hybrid work. Not every worker has the privilege of being able to work a hybrid schedule, be able to work from home or work remotely. But those of us who do, for those of us who do, I'm a huge fan. Now, I will say, to your point, it has created a set of challenges for organizations, leadership challenges. In pre-hybrid, pre-pandemic, we had the tools and technology. It just wasn't really a norm. It was an exception for you to work from home or work a hybrid kind of a schedule. Post-pandemic, we realized it is really possible. We can maintain our productivity levels and so on. From my sort of experience and know-how, I think one of the biggest issues it's created is how we train and develop young people. When I started my career, I went to the office every single day. I started my career at a manufacturing facility as an HR practitioner. I went to the office every day at 7 a.m. I got to watch, observe, be mentored, sort of have somebody show me and teach me how to do things on a hands-on basis, right? I was with people the entire time that I was in the office. And that's how I learned how to become a practitioner. I think one of the challenges we're faced with is how do we train, develop, build skills in young people when they are not physically sitting with others who would otherwise be in a position to teach them and develop them. I know there are ways of doing it. It's just really challenging us to find the most appropriate ways now of training and developing individuals. I think from my experience and a lot of clients I've worked with, this is sort of the biggest concern that they have. And then secondarily, it's around culture, right? How do we maintain, you know, we've worked so hard to build this culture that we're proud of. How do we maintain this culture when people are scattered all around the country, or sometimes even all around the world? And again, there are ways of doing it. We just have to learn and develop new skills of doing those things.
Yeah. Rick, something to add there.
Yeah. And one thing that I'll say is over the past couple decades, we were trending towards going more online and more remote. It just happened that COVID happened and then it just accelerated everything. So this was sort of the direction things were going in terms of workplaces. And one thing that I'll add is it really depends on whether or not a company is successful using flexible work or allowing people to work from home. It really depends on how the company, what makes sense for that company, right? Someone who's working in the job or someone who's in charge of making decisions, they'll know which positions could be, are allowed to be more flexible in terms of having people work from home, and which positions do we really need to have someone here in the morning, for example. So it really depends on what makes sense for the company. And ultimately, depending on the kind of person or job you're trying to fill, you're competing against other organizations. You know, a lot of people now, they don't want to wake up at 6 a.m. and get out the door at 7 and then drive an hour in traffic and be there at 8 if they don't have to. So there are pros and cons with deciding, okay, can we be successful by allowing someone to be flexible? And if not, is it a more of a personal issue that I have with it? Like, oh, I've always come in for the past 20 years. Now, is that attitude going to lead to success or not? So it's about adapting and being just adapting with, who you're recruiting, what are their expectations? And also understanding that, hey, if I'm going to make sure I have 100% of people here at 8 o'clock in the morning sharp, because that's the way I did it, just understand that some people might have, at 8 o'clock when they're there, at 4 o'clock when they leave, when they get home at 5, they're going to have a resume in someone else's inbox trying to find work that's a little bit more conducive to their lifestyle. So give and take.
Yeah, it's give and take. And there are, we can get off into this a bit, but there are advantages and disadvantages. Sometimes, like in my own situation, or somebody like me, when you're working with a team, you're seeing them every day, there's a chance to, you know, deal with little issues as they come up right on the spot. And if you're, I've heard this from another friend, if you don't get those things dealt with, they can kind of fester. So, how, you know, in that kind of situation, let's put it that way, how do you work things out? How does HR help in a situation like this, perhaps?
Yeah, so if you don't mind, Elisa, I can...
Yeah, no, go right ahead, Rick.
Yeah, thanks. So Larry, that's actually a great point. So one of the things we miss, and, you know, personally, I'm more of an in-person person when it comes to, like, teaching, et cetera. I like to be physically in the classroom because there's a lot of information, like, informal information people exchange with one another that's very important. And you can get a sense of someone's personality and not take things the wrong way. For example, if someone says something one way versus if you're in person and you understand how they are and it's not a big deal. In terms of what HR can do to help, when it's in person, it's a lot easier to not allow things to escalate. But another, I would also add to that, when you're not in person, there are things that can't happen in that can't happen online that can only happen in person, for example, right? So there's some interactions that might be unpleasant that now can be avoided because someone is working from home. Another thing that I'll add is in terms of problem solving or when there's an issue, the most important way to deal with any issue is to have clear expectations, leadership to establish clear expectations of, you know, this is how we treat each other, et cetera. No matter what the mode of communication is, mode as in whether someone is physically in the office or whether they're sending an email or whether they're on a Zoom call, you can convey respect and disrespect in each of those mediums. So the Lisa's point about a company's culture and how we treat each other, if I know I'm supposed to be respectful, et cetera, whether I'm emailing my my coworker or whether I'm in person with them or whether we're on a Zoom call, I'm going to make sure they know that I respect them and I'm going to talk to them in a way where they feel respected.
Makes good sense. So John wants to know, how do you balance being friendly with maintaining professional boundaries?
Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, that's a really great question, you know, as well. I'll say, you know, many years ago, I think I'll just use myself as an example, right? The whole idea of professionalism was, I'm here, you know, I'm working on my career, I'm here to do a job, I'm not here to make friends. More recently, Larry, there's been quite a bit of research. Gallup in particular has done a lot of research to demonstrate this is question, right, that they ask people, do you have a best friend at work? And all of the research really, really points to how important it is to have for us to have friends at work. Okay, maybe it's not a best friend, but maybe it's a work best friend, right? Those who answer yes to that question, yes, I have a best friend at work, are higher performers, more productive. Their retention is off the charts, right? They stay in these organizations. They're much more supportive as a colleague. They have a lot more empathy for the people that they work with. So I think it's a great question, right? You know, I'm not in any way saying come to work and be besties with everybody. There is certainly a level of professionalism that's always needed and required and expected in the workplace. And I think you want to err on the side of, right, you always want to be professional, but you don't want to sort of approach everybody thinking they're going to be your next best friend, right? Approach people in a friendly way, in an open way, in a transparent way. And the two of you know, your relationship will settle where it needs to settle. If you end up having and creating friends at work, that's fantastic. Some of my friends, I mentioned my first job at a automotive manufacturing facility. Some of my dearest friends to this day are the people I worked with 31, 32 years ago. We became friends at work and we maintained, you know, our friendship and relationship. So it's a balance, you know, that's required, and it does take quite a bit of self-awareness, which is another one of those things that we also focus on in the College of Business, and particularly at Marquette, right? We teach technical skills, but we also want to, you know, we want to produce good people, right? Good people who have quite a bit of self-awareness, right? They can read a room, they can respond. And I love this word adaptive that Rick mentioned. They can also be adaptive in the workplace as well.
Hmm. Rick, anything to add there?
Yeah, great points, Elisa. And one thing that I would add is it's about respecting boundaries, right? If you first meet someone, if you're overly casual, that might send the wrong signals. Even mm-hmm. though eventually the relationship may go there, just understand people also have expectations of professionalism or a respectable distance. And then over time, as people see, oh, is this person okay? Can we be friends? Can we not be friends? Then, you know, let a relationship, a workplace friendship develop organically. So the biggest thing that I would say is, you know, err on the side of professionalism, and the person you're interacting with, they'll let you know if they have a sense of humor, they'll throw a joke at you or not. And then that'll let you know, like, okay, I can joke around with this person while I can't joke around with another person. And that's completely okay. So just being aware of people's boundaries. Don't be too casual too soon, because if a person feels like you're disrespecting their boundaries, then they will see it as unprofessional. But if they see that you can approach them respectably first, then we'll see if this is actually a friendship, if I want to hang out with you after happy hours or not. So.
Elisa Nagel and Rick Laguerre, our guests today. Elisa, instructor of practice in the business management department at Marquette, and Rick Laguerre, an assistant professor of human resources at Marquette University, our guests. Questions for them or a comment, give us a call. What's going on in your workplace? Or do you have a question for them about HR? Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk about professionalism in the workplace with our guests from Marquette University, Elisa Nagel and Rick Laguerre. Great to have both of them with us. And again, you can join in, 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org if you want to send us an email. Jim and Cable has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Great topic. Very interesting. I've been an independent video producer for 35 or 36 years, and I was always astounded with how companies really kind of fall down on the job when it comes to retiring people and the lack of the ability to have them have the soon-to-be retiree pass their information on to other people coming up behind or other people in the company. I have one quick illustration of that. It was sort of a missed opportunity. I do a lot of work with heavy equipment and mining companies, and OSHA is responsible for inspecting construction sites, but MSHA is the organization that's responsible for inspecting mines. And I had a customer who had a really dynamic guy that put on a PowerPoint presentation called How to Survive an MSHA Inspection. And he would take it around the country and present it to all the field offices, and everybody loved it. So this guy was going to retire, and they hired me to produce a video about how to survive an MSHA inspection. I was really excited. About a week before I flew to Dallas, I got a call, and the guy passed away. So there was no opportunity to do that. But I just thought, this is such a missed opportunity, I think, for companies to use technology, especially video and storytelling and all the other good things in media, to pass along institutional knowledge within the company. And I just wondered what your guests' thoughts were about that.
Oh, Jim, thanks for calling. Let's see. Elisa, we can start with you this time.
Yeah, no, what a great comment and observation, and I completely agree with you. This is really a missed opportunity. Now, caveat this by saying this is not an area I've researched, so my comments and feedback are anecdotal and based on my experience. But I would say a part of that maybe has to do with, I would say, I'm assuming your experiences with an American-based company, U.S. company. Might say that from my experience, a part of that may just unfortunately be a unique aspect of the American culture. We don't really age or value, age in our organization. Once you get to be a certain age, we tend to think that they're, you know, from a productivity standpoint, we don't really have much more use for you. From my experience, this isn't necessarily an issue in other parts of the world, where there is quite a bit of respect and deference that's given to people who have many, many years of experience. A lot of attention is given to their institutional know-how and expertise, and that knowledge transfer is a really important and critical part of transitioning those individuals out of the workforce. But all of that said, I do agree with you. That's been my observation as well. Now, I have seen some organizations do it better than others. When there is time to plan and prepare for someone's eventual departure or, you know, retirement, I think there are many, many opportunities that are enabled now through, like you said, through technology, you know, to be able to do that. But I'll turn it over to Rick, because I know, Rick, quite a bit of your research is done just exactly around sort of the whole life cycle of an employee, right, from point that they're hired until they retire. So I'm sure you'll have a lot more. Thoughtful.
Yeah, I bet. Rick, what do you think?
Yeah, this is actually my specialty area. So how to ensure older workers age successfully at work. Part of that is retaining their knowledge and allowing them to transfer it to other people. So in terms of your example, Jim, I would say that's definitely unfortunate, but unfortunately, that's not too uncommon, right? People retire, they'll have health issues. They may not just pass away, but they might have health issues that take them out of work before they retire. So we have a term for this. We call it succession planning, but it's just a fancy way of saying that planning for a successor and having policies and practices in place where more senior people are working with more junior people. So if this individual who was going around giving speeches about how to survive MSHA inspection, MSHA, for the listeners who aren't aware, it's the Mine Safety and Health Administration inspection. But so what ideally what would have been happening before this point is you would have been shadowing this person or working with them long before we were at that point where there might have been something happening. So if someone's within 5 years of retiring or something like that, I would make an argument and say, hey, is there someone working with them that they can, is there a younger person or a more newer person working with them that can learn from them? One thing that is I would also say is that people who have a tremendous amount of knowledge and expertise in a given area, they're very, very successful. And when people are successful, they're motivated by different things. And one of the things that motivates people as in their retirement is passing on knowledge and expertise and helping other people develop. So just having a strategy where you pair newer entry-level employees with people who are already seasoned and experienced with the job, doing it not a year before retirement, but a few years out, 5 years, 6 years, that'll enable someone to grab the reins of in your example, the MSHA inspections, if an emergency happened and the senior leadership or the senior supervisor or person giving the speech unfortunately left the workplace or passed away. So it's just about starting sooner and having systems and strategies and policies in place that enable newer employees to work with more seasoned employees. And that knowledge will be naturally passed on.
Jim, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Another emailer wondering about gossiping and bullying. They're probably common in workplaces, and I think she gets maybe getting a little of this in where she is. What can you do to avoid becoming a part of something hurtful at your office or job site when it comes to that?
I can jump in here. So yeah, that's actually, you know, gossiping and bullying. So bullying, everyone kind of knows it's bad. Like from a young age, when you're in elementary school, you think of a bully like a bigger person just coming and shoving you against the locker or taking your lunch money or something like that. But when people are, you know, at work and adults, that doesn't happen anymore, but it comes off in different ways. It could be directly by talking meanly to a person or being disrespectful to someone, or indirectly by talking, gossiping or talking about someone behind their back. Now, in terms of, you know, it is definitely a bad thing. I'll just fast forward here. You don't have to do a whole interview or read a whole bunch of studies. It's a bad thing. It stresses people out. So essentially, how to avoid it. One thing that I would suggest is to try not to take part in it where possible, right? There are going to be people who gossip and maybe form a clique around them and start talking, et cetera. It's healthy to be away from that. Try not to be directly involved in that. Now, if you are the target of gossip, there are some ways that you can deal with it, depending on the severity, right? One is to try to talk to the person. It's like, hey, how are you doing? You know, I'm hearing that people are saying this about me. Do you know who it might be coming from? So one, by talking to someone, the person who's got, let's say you know 100% who's gossiping. By letting them know you're aware of the gossip, usually when someone is gossiping, they think that you don't know that it's them, or that you're not aware of it. But so just by making someone aware that you know that this thing is being said about you, it might give them a signal, hey, maybe one, I shouldn't be saying this, or two, maybe I should be more careful so that it doesn't become a problem for the person being gossiped about. There's also another range, depending on what the gossip is. You know, the employee has a way to, you can escalate. You can talk to your leadership, your manager, your supervisor, say, hey, you know, there's gossip, this is not right. And you are in the right. What people don't realize is if there's a wrong being done to you, you are 100% in your right to speak up for yourself and to advocate for yourself when no one else will do it for you. So I would say you can definitely escalate to leadership and have leadership maybe send a message to everyone. Hey, there's gossip going on. This is not tolerated here. Please leave it outside of here. Whatever you talk about, we don't talk about each other that way here. So maybe it's just a matter of leadership sending a signal to everyone without isolating the gossiper and creating more drama. So there are strategies, and it's just picking the right one that works.
Right, those are really good. And I would just add too that this is where also your HR practitioner can become a really important resource to you. Now, I know not every HR person is a good HR person or is someone that you can trust. Hopefully you've got an HR professional in your organization who you do trust. And one of the skills that we teach here, but other universities teach HR majors as well, is this really important skill of coaching, right? So you don't go to your HR person with a complaint, like Rick was saying, hey, so-and-so was gossiping, and they say, okay, I'm going to go take care of it for you, right? A really good HR practitioner has deep insights about the organization, right? HR people are the only people who see an organization the way that they do. Nobody else sees it the way that they do. And this is what makes them really, really valuable inside an organization. So you go to your HR practitioner, you have a, you know, one-on-one conversations with them, and they will coach you through this, right? They'll help to provide you some ideas, some thoughts around how you might be able to successfully and effectively address this issue. Again, because they know the organization quite well, if you're experiencing something like Rick said, you're not in a vacuum, right? Others are also seeing and experiencing those same issues as well. So I think to Rick's point, yeah, if you've got a great boss that you trust and you can go talk to and your boss is going to coach you with this, that's fantastic. Or consider going to your HR practitioner. Part of their job is to be a coach.
Alisa, Rick.
Yeah.
Thank you both very much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we can do this again down the road. Alisa Nagel and Rick Laguerre, both with the Marquette University. It's great to have them with us. And it's great to have you listening in. Thank you so much for listening. and stay with us. Lots in store on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.